From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what the Republican primary race reveals about the state of the party and the state of American politics, we talk with Ronald Brownstein, co-author of Storming the Gates, Protest Politics and the Republican Revival. He's national political correspondent for the LA Times. Also, we look back on the life and music of the late alto saxophonist Art Pepper with his widow Lori Pepper. She co-wrote his autobiography and has been helping to reissue his recordings. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Juror. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Saying he hopes lawmakers will set aside partisanship and divisions, President Clinton today sent Congress the outline of his budget proposal for 1997 and plans for balancing the budget over the next 7 years. The $1.6 trillion package represents a 4% increase over projected spending for this year. The 20-page outline is a lot like the last offer the president put on the table in early January. Shortly after making that offer, GOP bargainers broke off the face-to-face negotiating, saying it would resume only after the White House made a more serious offer. The death of Sergeant First Class Donald Dugan in Bosnia this weekend hit home in a South Dakota community where the soldier and his family lived and worked for several years. Tom Sorensen of South Dakota Public Radio reports.
The Military Science Department at the University of South Dakota is planning a memorial service honoring 38-year-old Donald Dugan, according to friend and former colleague Lieutenant Colonel William Lesser, who heads the school's ROTC program. Flags on campus were lowered to half-staff Saturday upon word of Dugan's death. Lesser says although Dugan was an Ohio native, in the 3 years living in this South Dakota town of 10,000, Dugan made many friends and acquaintances. So did his wife Miriam and their two daughters, Dixie and Beverly. Dugan often rode his bicycle the 10 blocks or so to campus where he worked from June of 1992 to July of last year. And he and his wife also operated a downtown lunch counter for several years. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Sorensen in Vermilion, South Dakota.
GOP presidential candidate Steve Forbes is calling on Senator Bob Dole to pull an ad that says Forbes' flat tax proposal would raise the taxes of New Hampshire families. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more.
Forbes is getting a taste of his own medicine, and he doesn't like it. He's outraged by the New Hampshire ad, which features Governor Steve Merrill calling the flat tax plan bad for New Hampshire taxpayers. Forbes says the ad doesn't take into account the standard personal exemptions his plan will include for each family member, which would lower the tax burden.
So I'm calling upon the Dole campaign to remove this ad based on a bogus study, based on bogus arithmetic.
But the Dole campaign is standing by its ad as accurate, and Governor Merrill says studies show the middle class will pay more under the Forbes plan. The claim depends on the definition of middle class and what specific deductions an individual or family is used to making. 70% of Americans do not itemize deductions and already fill out a simple one-page form. I'm Elizabeth Arnold, reporting.
Nearly a quarter of a million North Carolina residents are still without electricity as crews work to repair ice-down power lines. Frigid air pushed out of the Midwest and into the South and Mid-Atlantic. In Florida, citrus and vegetable growers are racing to protect their crops. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 10 points at 53.84.10. This is NPR News. The nation's second-largest stock market turns 25 years old this week. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The Nasdaq stock market began on February 8, 1971, as a computerized system to display prices of stocks that didn't trade on organized exchanges like the New York Stock Exchange. But by the late 1980s, Nasdaq had grown rapidly and was known as a community for technology stocks. Nasdaq's success has not been without growing pains. Nasdaq and its dealers now are the subject of exhaustive price-fixing investigations by the Justice Department and the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's alleged that National Association of Securities Dealers and large Nasdaq dealers conspired on prices and victimized customers. A second crisis on the Nasdaq centered around mutual funds. The boom in such funds and the flood of money into technology stocks led to heavy trading of Nasdaq stocks, and computers were overwhelmed by the volume. There are significant changes ahead for Nasdaq. It's proposing a major overhaul of how customers' orders are handled. critics and supporters agree that these reforms and NASDAQ's established reputation bode well for the next 25 years. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
O.J. Simpson phoned into a live television broadcast today where he took questions about his murder trial. Simpson claims his ex-wife Nicole wrote allegations of domestic abuse to get out of a prenuptial agreement. His call to CNN's burden of proof led to Simpson's first extended public comments about the facts of the double murder case in which he was acquitted. He also said he's convinced that the murders are somehow related to the activities of Faye Resnick, who'd been a friend of his ex-wife and who'd been treated for cocaine abuse shortly before the slayings. Authorities in Vista, California, will perform autopsies today on the bodies of five people found bludgeoned to death in a burned-out condominium. According to a San Diego newspaper, a 15-year-old boy arrested yesterday has confessed to killing his parents, grandparents, and sister before setting fire to the condo. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Iowa caucuses are next week. The New Hampshire primary is the week after that. We invited Ronald Brownstein to examine the Republican campaign and see what it reveals about larger patterns within the Republican Party. Brownstein is co-author of the book Storming the Gates, Protest Politics and the Republican Revival. The book traces the story behind the Republican congressional victory of 94 and looks at the forces that have made the party more conservative, more populist, and even more anti-government today than it was a decade ago. Brownstein has been covering the presidential campaign for the Los Angeles Times, where he is national political correspondent. I asked him if he thinks the Republican Party has been reconfigured in the past couple of years.
You know, at the end of the Bush administration, the Republican Party really looked dead on its feet, not only politically but intellectually. I mean, Bush seemed to just sort of run down. I mean, when he was moved out of the White House by the voters, it seemed to ratify a fact that was already in place, which is that this administration had run out of energy, had run out of ideas. The classic moment of the 92 campaign was when Bush looked at his watch during that debate in Richmond, and it seemed to be sort of summarize what was going on. But there were forces beneath the surface that Bush, as well as Bob Michael and Bob Dole in their own way, had bottled up. They came from a generation that was more conventional in their conservatism. And in fact, all of whom had grown up in the period when Democrats dominated national politics, and in the eyes of many conservatives, I think fairly, none of those figures really ever lost their sense that they were there as the party of opposition rather than as a potential majority party. And I think what's really happened is with Bush's defeat, the cork in the bottle, as we say in the book, was removed. And much more aggressively conservative forces that believe the Republican Party a natural majority party, have really ascended to assume the dominant position of control within the GOP. And this really runs across the board, and I think that's one of the points we try to make most strongly. It's not just young conservatives in Congress who are inspired by and to some extent model themselves on Newt Gingrich, especially the young Newt Gingrich. That's one element of it. There's a generational transition in political leadership. But the same kind of process is going on in interest groups, as groups like the National Rifle Association, the Christian Coalition, even the small business lobby become much more militantly conservative than they were 10 years ago. And also on the intellectual front, where you have people like Charles Murray and Bill Bennett offering a much more fundamental critique, a rationale for a much more fundamental assault on the welfare state than even the neoconservatives during the 60s and 70s.
Are you trying to read the primaries, the Republican primaries, to see what that has to say about the state of the party?
I think the centerpiece of our argument is that at the end of the Cold War, many people thought the Republican Party and the conservative coalition in general was going to splinter because communism had provided opposition to communism had provided the unifying focus for conservatives really since World War II. But what we found, I think, is that opposition to Washington has succeeded opposition to communism as the central organizing principle for the Republican Party. And if you look carefully at the Republican candidates, each of them are trying in their own way to identify themselves as the candidate most committed to accelerating the anti-government revolution that Republicans ran on in 1994. Bob Dole carries around a copy of the 10th Amendment in his pocket and promises to block grant large portions of federal programs to the states. Phil Graham has placed his bet on persistent and dogged budget cutting. I mean, that really is almost a single note. He laid out an economic plan the other day that envisioned the federal government being reduced to 15% of the economy by the end of a second Graham term. That's one-third smaller than it is now and smaller than at any time since the Korean War. Then you have Lamar Alexander, who is tried, you know, with his flannel shirt and cut their pay and send them home, and very much a procedural, Perot-esque outsider critique of Washington. But he has been trumped, as Graham has been trumped, and Dole has been threatened by Steve Forbes, who has managed through the flat tax and term limits to most successful, and of course his own non-politician persona, to so far most successfully tie into this new driving force of the Republican coalition, which is opposition to Washington. And I think one thing that's pretty clear is that Forbes' support is not totally linked to the flat tax. Indeed, in many polls, he continues to rise as support for the flat tax goes down. Forbes is more broadly, and the flat tax is a symbol of this, attaching himself to this idea of we've got to keep punishing the politicians, we've got to rein in Washington. He presents even the flat tax essentially as a way of reining in Washington, arguing that the tax code is the principal source of power and political corruption.
In your book Storming the Gates, you talk about two of the major forces that have helped to reconfigure the Republican Party, as being the Christian Coalition and the Perot movement, Perot mm-hmm. supporters. How do you see the Perot movement as figuring in to the Steve Forbes constituency now? Do you think those are the same people? Do you think it's basically the same movement behind a different candidate?
So far there seems to be a lot of overlap. I was struck by a figure from the recent Boston Globe poll that had Forbes ahead in New Hampshire, that some 40% of the people who said they were going to vote for him were people who voted for Ross Perot in 1992. The Perot constituency has to be sort of dissected, really bisected. There really are two portions of it. There's a upscale, college-educated, suburban engineer, really, constituency. I sort of think of my father-in-law, who worked for Hughes Aircraft, as sort of the prototypical college-educated Perot voter. But as you look at sort of the bulk of the Perot constituency, and by the way, that first constituency are the volunteers, the people you see in the offices, and the sort of the image of the good government-concerned citizen who feels that both parties are not really dealing seriously with our problems. But increasingly in polling, and in fact even in 92, the larger part of the Perot constituency is the most disaffected bloc really in Americans, which are non-college educated white voters, people who have been losing ground in the economy over the last 20 years, who may be culturally conservative but are feeling economically squeezed. And these people are not a stable long-term fit in either party. Nor is it clear to me that if somehow Steve Forbes became the Republican nominee, that he could really hold on to them, given his pedigree and the economic distributional effects of his flat tax. The fact that neither party really has a clear answer to the economic problems of the three-quarters of the workforce that don't have college degrees is one reason why we project a period of sustained turbulence in American politics. It seems to me unlikely that either party is really going to be able to solve the problems facing these voters and thus secure their long-term allegiance, which is necessary to any kind of stable realignment.
Ronald Brownstein is my guest. He's co-author of the new book, Storming the Gates, Protest Politics and the Republican Revival, and he's national political correspondent for the LA Times. Let's look at Bob Dole for a second. How do you think he has changed his agenda in response to the young Republican conservatives that have gained so much power in Congress? Do you think he has?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the central stories in the book is the decade-long battle for dominance of Republican economic policy between Dole and the young conservatives in the House. In the early 80s, it was Jack Kemp and Trent Lott. Later on, it was Newt Gingrich. Dole represented a traditional Republican view which put the preeminent priority on balancing the budget. And as such, in 82, he pursued a tax increase to try to reduce some of the deficit left by the 81 Reagan tax cuts. And that put him into direct conflict with Kemp. Again, in 84, over the Republican platform, the supply-siders and the young conservatives wanted it to be a core anti-tax document. In 85, when Dole pursued not a tax increase, but a very ambitious package of spending cuts that passed the Senate by one vote, they had a wheel Pete Wilson on a gurney from the hospital to pass it. But then Kemp led an effort that convinced Reagan to abandon it. And then again, of course, in 1990, when Gingrich led the fight against the Bush budget summit agreement that Dole supported. And somewhere along the way in there, Gingrich called Dole the tax collector for the welfare state. Well, after 94, I think that Dole has made his decision clearly made a decision that the only way he was going to be the Republican nominee was to convince these forces in the party that he had battled with quite a bit during the 80s, that he would be a faithful steward of their revolution. And he undertook a series of efforts to mollify them. He signed the anti-tax pledge, the commitment not to raise taxes in office that he refused to sign in 88 and which was used against him in New Hampshire. He promised the National Rifle Association he would repeal the assault weapon ban. He reached out to the Christian conservatives with his anti-Hollywood rhetoric and, you know, seemed to be doing quite well at blurring the distinctions with the other mainstream candidates. Then Forbes comes along and sort of creates a whole different set of comparisons, insider, outsider, politician, non-politician, as well as moving the bar higher on taxes. It wasn't enough now that Bob Dole said he would not raise taxes as president. Now he also had to support this flat tax.
Dole hasn't been doing as well as expected, I think that's fair to say, so far. And how do you interpret that? What does that say?
Well, Bob Dole's strengths are many. And he is, but they are the strengths of a legislator. They are not the strengths necessarily of an executive. You know, he is enormously respected on both sides of the aisle in Washington as a very skilled legislator who gets things done, who moves things forward. I mean, even something like the Voting Rights Act extension in 1982. I mean, on a variety of issues, he is someone whose word is considered good, who is skilled and agile. But he is not very good at sort of saying, this is where the country ought to go. He is much more, you know, I saw him the other day in Iowa talking about the flat tax. And He was saying at one point that we ought to, you know, this thing hasn't been vetted. There haven't been hearings on it. People haven't come in and told us what the problems are. And that's how we'll find out what's wrong with it. And on the one hand, my initial reaction was, oh, there's Bob Dole again. You know, no vision, just a legislator, an inbox president. And yet, as I sat there and thought about it, I thought there was a certain integrity to what he was saying. And that I think, envisions really the legislative process as sort of the town square, you know, of America, how we make decisions, which is everybody comes in, all the interests come in and sort of whack the politicians around. And from that combat, we get maybe not the best result, but something that basically everybody can live with. That is, for better or worse, who he is. The problem is that Americans often want in a president, usually want in a president, someone who is going to do more than simply broker among the competing demands. They want someone who's going to sort of chart out a path himself. And on that front, Dole has always been lacking. I'm struck by the words of one man last week in Iowa City who said to me, I think Bob Dole will be a very respectable president. He's eminently qualified to be president, but he's going to give us what we have, and I want something different.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ronald Brownstein. He's co-author of the new book, Storming the Gates, Protest Politics and the Republican Revival. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ronald Brownstein. He's national political correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and the author of a new book about the Republican revival. One of the forces that you write about behind the Republican revival is the Christian Coalition. And in this election, the Christian Coalition is not behind one particular candidate. The people in the coalition are divided between several candidates. What does that say to you?
Well, that's diffused their impact in the early states. The Christian Coalition as an organization made a conscious effort to avoid anointing or endorsing a candidate because they don't want to be seen as kingmakers in the Republican Party and become the focus of backlash. So in the early states, the Christian Coalition impact is reduced because it's splitting between Buchanan, Dole, Graham, even Alan Keyes. As the race narrows to one-on-one, particularly if it is someone against Steve Forbes, either Bob Dole or even Phil Graham for that matter, they could be potentially significantly more of a force because it is possible then they could unify against Forbes, who they view as sort of squishy on social issues.
So do you think that they're becoming any less powerful or more powerful within the Republican Party?
I think more powerful, actually. I mean, I talked to Steve Forbes on Friday, and he said to me for the first time that ultimately, you know what he said about abortion often is that we have to change the culture and so forth. But he hadn't really been clear on whether he would ultimately change the law, and many people have cited articles in which he seemed to have said that abortion should remain legal during the first 24 weeks of pregnancy. But he did say to me that ultimately he would support banning abortion, except in cases of rape, incest, and life of the mother. The Republicans are operating in a narrowing boundary of permissible dissent on this issue, and that is largely a function of the growing power, not only of the Christian Coalition itself, but of evangelical conservatives more broadly in their political coalition.
Two of the forces that you see as being very important in the reshaping of the Republican Party are the Christian Coalition and the independents, the people who are behind Perot, some of whom are behind Forbes now. Do you think that the Christian Coalition and the independent voters are taking the Republican Party in kind of opposite directions?
Yeah, there are pulling in opposite directions in many instances, especially the upscale portion of the Perot vote, which you talked about before, which tends to be very pro-choice. The importance of the Christian Coalition and more broadly, really, the evangelical Christian vote to the Republican Coalition, I think, has reached the level where I no longer think it's feasible that you could have a truly pro-choice Republican presidential candidate any more than you could have a Democratic presidential candidate who was truly opposed to affirmative action. I just don't think that it is sustainable given the nature of their electorate and the people they have to support. But you know, there is one point at which both of these divergent interests and many of the other divergent interests in the Republican Party can agree, which is reducing the role of the federal government. I mean, I think that is something that unites conservative Christians and Perot voters. The risk is that there are a lot of Americans out there who are uneasy with the specifics of how the Republicans interpret that broad mandate, and that gives a certain power to the argument from Bill Clinton, which is that you need me here to keep them from going too far.
What kind of state do you think the Democratic Party is in right now?
I think the Democratic Party has a very difficult time figuring out exactly what its role is going to be in this new era. I thought that although the book is primarily about the Republicans, we have a long chapter in there looking at the Democratic struggle through the 80s to find a winning agenda and message that could bring them back to the White House. And the party went through several steps. In 84, with Mondale, a sort of return to liberal fundamentalism, the idea being that Carter wasn't a real Democrat. We needed to go back to a real Democrat, and that's how we win the White House. And, you know, he won one state. In 88, with Dukakis, you get neoliberalism, which was a more moderate economics but traditional liberal views on social policy and foreign policy. And, of course, he got whacked out pretty good by George Bush on those issues. And then in 92, as we talk about, you had the development of the new Democratic agenda, which combined a sort of populist economics with a much more culturally conservative tone, really a sort of double-barreled cultural and economic populism. And for a variety of reasons that we go through in 93, 94, Clinton was not able to convince the Democratic Congress or the country to follow him on many of those paths, and he was sort of pushed back into the same corners that Dukakis had been in by the time of the 94 election. As a result, in 95, Clinton has had to cede an awful lot more ground to the Republicans. I mean, the State of the Union in 96 was not the speech that he ran to give, no matter what he says about consistency in his message. He envisioned reinvigorating as well as reinventing government. Now he's in a position largely of reducing it.
The Republican victory in the House and the Senate was in part because particularly many of the young conservative Republicans ran on a kind of anti-government platform, and that really worked for them. Now many of them are in government. They're part of government. Do you think that the Republican Party will be able to control the anti-government tide that it helped to create, or do you think that that tide might turn against them too?
Oh, I think it's clearly already turning against them. They're having trouble holding on to it. You look at Gingrich's disapproval rating. You look at the low approval rating of Congress. It's very hard to reverse what we're in, which is a broad social alienation, really, from the political system and political leadership. And it is, I think, going to be very difficult for either party to truly control this. And that's one of the reasons why in the book we project, rather than a Republican realignment, where Republicans would dominate national politics in the same way that Democrats did in the generation after FDR, I think it's more likely that we're going to have a period of sustained turmoil because neither party can truly, I think, resolve the anxieties about the course of American life that feed into this alienation from government. And as such, they're both going to be, to some extent, at the mercy of it.
So you think we're in a period of political instability right now, which is hurting both parties?
Yeah.
Or is going to hurt the Republicans soon, you think?
Mostly, I think hurt them in the sense that, you know, in the past, when we've had realigning, what political scientists call realigning elections, generally one party has been able to dominate control of the White House and Congress for at least 12 years, long enough to pass their agenda. 1828, 1860, 1896, 1932. Each time, the party that won the White House in that realigning election was also controlled Congress. They had unified control of government. Since 68, we've fallen into a period of divided control of government for which there's really very little precedence in our history, really only before the Civil War in the last 20 years of the 19th century. Republicans, if they are going to achieve the kinds of goals they've set out, really need, 95 proves this, they need unified control of government. You can't make the kind of revolutionary change without control of the White House and Congress, as Clinton's vetoes have demonstrated. The frustration may be that we may be in a period where the public does not trust either party enough to give them the kind of unified control of government that previous dominant coalitions have exercised.
Are you going to be in Iowa next week?
I will be in Iowa as of tomorrow.
Is that an exciting time for you, or does it become a drag after a while, you know, the more horse race aspect of politics?
Well, what I try to focus on is, what I write about usually, is the debate between and within the parties and how it evolves and what it says about the country and what it says about the changing center of gravity in each of these political coalitions. So it's fascinating to me to watch the arguments play out. And I think that I enjoy very much going out and talking to the voters. Trailing after the candidates can get a little tedious. And as I said before, sort of predicting what's going to happen can drive you crazy. I'm personally very pleased that we're finally at the point where people are voting and they can start talking, they can start casting their verdicts instead of all of us sitting around here casting our verdicts, which are really based on air.
Does it ever get hard to find people who are from Iowa because there's so many press people around that everyone you run into is really from the press?
You know, there are times you walk down the street in Des Moines and you feel like you're on Connecticut Avenue. It's very disconcerting.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Ronald Brownstein is co-author of Storming the Gates, Protest Politics and the Republican Revival. He's also a national political correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now we'd like to close this first set with our rendition of the tune that the Bible of the jazz musician. If you can't play this, don't play Cherokee.
Coming up, we look back on the life and music of alto saxophonist Art Pepper. We talk with Lori Pepper, who has been helping to reissue the recordings of her late husband. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In spite of his self-destructive instincts, alto saxophonist Art Pepper managed to leave behind an impressive body of recordings before he died of a stroke at the age of 56 in 1982. He started his career playing with Stan Kenton and Shorty Rogers. In 1950, he got himself addicted to heroin. 3 years later, he was imprisoned on a narcotics charge. He spent the better part of the next 13 years in prison, five of those years in San Quentin. In the late 60s, while he was in rehab at Synanon, he met a woman also in rehab who became his wife. Lori Pepper helped him resume his career and co-wrote his acclaimed autobiography, Straight Life. Now she's helping to reissue his recordings. The latest include a box set of his Vanguard sessions from 1977 and his sessions with tenor player Zoot Sims. When Art Pepper died, jazz critic Gary Giddens wrote, "Pepper made so much depend on the integrity and substance of each chorus that watching him play was an eerie sort of adventure. He was always proving something." Before we ask Lori Pepper to talk about her late husband's life, let's listen to a 1980 recording reissued on the box set The Complete Galaxy Recordings. When you tried to help Art Pepper reestablish himself musically after he got out of rehab, what were some of the obstacles you faced in convincing clubs or booking agents or record producers to take a chance and work with him?
Well, now, this is interesting because when we moved in together after Synanon, we did it because we wanted to be together and because I wanted to work on the book, Straight Life. And I had no ambitions for him musically. And he, because he had none, or he seemed to have none, he was working as a bookkeeper at that time. And he thought that getting back into music would destroy him. And he was also very frightened of having to prove himself again. My God, I mean, the amount of energy and passion that he put into that, that ambition took out of him was, you know, it was pretty formidable. So he gave me the impression that he didn't want to play music anymore. And so a friend of his got some jobs for him doing bar mitzvahs and weddings, you know, and he was making his living doing that. And then somebody got him a job doing a clinic, a saxophone clinic at a college, or I think it was a clarinet clinic, the first one. And there was never any idea that he would be a musician again, touring. So that did not come from me, and it didn't come from him either. It came from outside.
Did you get advice from other women who were married to jazz musicians and who were managing or helping to manage their husbands' careers.
Yeah, and that happened around the Vanguard date, too. At that time, I didn't see. When we went on that tour and went to the Vanguard, I didn't know that that was going to be my role. I really didn't see myself as his manager or anything. I was just going along. And then I met Keiko Jones, Elvin Jones' wife. And during this horrendous experience, every evening, Keiko would lecture me about what to do, what to wear, how to act. And as I said in my afterword to Straight Life, how much power to take. And she said, all of it, all of it. And she was one tough lady. She used to set up Elvin's drums for him and order him around, this big, frightening guy. I mean, it was really something. So I learned a lot from Keiko. Also, Phil Wood's partner, Jill Goodwin, she came over to our house and we talked for a while. And she was wonderful. She was telling me more of the practical aspects of managing. So I began to realize that that was going to be my job.
What did Keiko Jones tell you about what to wear?
Well, at that time, I was wearing jeans. I was wearing jeans and T-shirts. That's all I ever wore. And she told me I had to dress better. I had to look prosperous, and I had to look elegant. Well, that didn't bother me at all. And in a short time, I went out and bought a lot of expensive clothes. That was no problem for me.
And for whose sake should you have looked prosperous and elegant?
Oh, well, for art, you know, so that that people would recognize that he was important and that he made a lot of money and he had status and they would pay us a lot of money. And, you know, I think she was right.
Was it ever hard for you, as a woman married to a jazz musician, to get respect from other musicians or from club owners or whatever? Were you treated as an individual or as the wife?
Great question. I love that question. Nobody's ever asked me that question. Yes, it was horrible. Not always. Sometimes it was just great and people treated me great. But there were other occasions where I would have to say, Art, will you come and tell this person that they have to listen to me, that I am speaking for you? And so he would. In Japan especially, you know, I mean, in Japan women are really invisible and beside the point. And so because I was in charge of the sound for the band, you know, and I was in charge of the sound guy in the various venues we went to, and I learned the Japanese words for louder and softer and stuff like that, I mean, these guys would ignore me utterly. And these, some of them were kids, you know, a great deal younger than me, but I had to take Art by the hand with an interpreter, and he had to say, she is speaking for me. And it sometimes was rough. The other part that was rough was that Art would complain to me about things where he didn't like confrontations and he didn't like to complain. So I had to be the bad guy. So he would complain about something. For instance, he hated drummers to do double time during a ballad, but he wouldn't tell them that. I had to tell them that. And if I didn't tell them that, then they would play double time during a ballad. And if I did, they wouldn't believe me. So it was kind of, you know, it was, yes.
So that put you in the position sometimes, too, probably, of looking like the nag.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I think I got kind of famous as being a real, you know, tiresome bitch. But, you know, I kind of liked it. All my life I'd been so nice.
Would he ask you about tunes that should be in his repertoire or get your impressions of his playing?
Yeah. He, poor guy, he did, and I told him. Generally, I would be the one who would compile the list of tunes for an individual set. He was usually too nervous beforehand to compile a good list. And what I would see him do is go out and play a whole bunch of tunes that were all pretty much the same kind of tune. And he agreed that there should be a variation. In fact, maybe it was even Keiko that told me that. I don't know. At any rate, so I began to be the one. I would give him a list of tunes. And he would show it to the guys, and that would be it. So he would do that. There were times when I would suggest that it would be wonderful if he would play a given tune. I would bring things home and play them for him. You know, yeah, there was a lot of that. That's part of what I was also talking about the respect that he gave me, You know, the fact that he would discuss these things with me as if I knew what I was talking about was pretty nice.
Where did your musical tastes diverge?
I was absolutely crazy about gospel music. And Art liked it, but I think it was chord-wise, I think it was too simple for him. He couldn't get into it because the chords were too simple. But he loved the emotion in it. I also liked very, very old-timey blues. And Art found it annoying to listen to that because their time wasn't good. They would speed up and slow down. It would drive him crazy. So that's where our musical tastes diverged. But mostly we liked a lot of the same stuff. He wouldn't admit it, but he loved a lot of he loved Doris Day. He loved singers, good singers with, you know, emotion and everything, and so did I. We both loved Barbara Streisand, but, you know, we both loved Paul Simon. There were a lot of things that it wasn't cool to admit that he liked, that I could admit that I liked. But privately, right. We had great conversations about those things.
My guest is Lori Pepper. She's helping to reissue the recordings of her late husband, alto saxophonist Art Pepper. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lori Pepper, we're talking about her late husband, alto saxophonist Art Pepper. Many of his recordings are getting reissued. This is from the reissue of his 1957 album, Art Pepper Meets the Rhythm Section. Traveling with him, whether it was New York to play at the Vanguard or Tokyo to play concerts there. He was on methadone maintenance, and he was using other drugs as well. So what was it like when you were on the road?
Hell. It was like hell. When we traveled in Japan, I had to hide the methadone because no matter what, the fact that it was a prescription item for him didn't matter. They wouldn't let it into the country.
Methadone was illegal there?
Totally. Totally. We had a thing from the head of the Veterans Administration Hospital, and we were told, won't do you any good in Japan. You can't bring it in. So we had to hide it. I hid it in a shampoo bottle. Every time we went through any kind of checkout in any airport, and there were a lot of airports, I was shaking in my shoes that they would find it. In addition, I had to constantly monitor Art's use of it because if he could, he would take more than what he was supposed to. And I generally would have to hide it or lock it up or whatever. I've talked to women, lots of women who have been involved with men who are alcoholic or whatever, and I don't think I would have stuck it without that gift. The gift was there were a few things. The gift was one of them. The other thing was the way he treated me, which was very well. I mean, he gave me so much respect. He never criticized me. He thought I was terrific. He told everybody I was great. He wanted to believe that I was everything that he needed and told me that I was and told everybody else that I was, and so I did it. And that was a great learning experience for me, too, to find out what my capacities were.
There's one point on one of the sessions where he mentions you. This isn't an introduction.
Oh, that's not too nice. Yeah,
no, right. It's not. In fact, why don't I just play it here?
All right.
My last album, I was lucky enough to have recorded it with Elvin on drums and George Cables on piano and David Williams on bass, called Art Pepper the Trip on Contemporary. And the record before that with called Art Pepper Living Legend with the late Hampton Hawes on piano, Charlie Hayden on bass, and Shelly Mann on drums. They're both for sale in the back by my wife. Wave your hand, baby. That pretty little, sweet little Jewish freak right there. That's my seventh woman. If I lose her, I'll go get an eighth. But I hope she don't leave me because I needs her. Thank you. See you later.
That remark, which really was, that's about as low as he ever got. And the reason was this. He had been using the money. This was before I took control of the money, actually. He had been using the money that we had gotten to pay off a counselor at the methadone program in New York to buy extra methadone, instead of using it to pay our hotel bill. I grabbed the money and paid the hotel bill with it. He was furious. I also said I was going to get that counselor in trouble. So he was very, very angry at me that night. But that's about as bad as it ever got. Usually, if you heard his comments on stage, he was lovely. He was lovely.
I'd like to play some more music from the Vanguard sessions that have just been released. And he plays Cherokee twice. Mm-hmm. On this, the first time he plays it, he talks about how, you know, no jazz musician is worth anything if they can't play the heck out of this tune.
Mm-hmm.
And then he proceeds to burn through it.
Right.
We're going to hear the second version that he plays. What were your impressions of this performance?
When I realized that he was going to play Cherokee on that particular night where he was just so totally dissipated, I couldn't believe his nerve.
Because he takes it at such a fast pace?
Well, he always took it at a fast pace. I knew what he was going to do if he played Cherokee. And the idea that he believed that he could do that, that he could pull it off, there was no risk he would not take on stage. He was amazing. So my state was, he can't do it, number one, and number two, what nerve. What nerve. And then when I heard it, my God, he's doing it. He was a hell of a ride, you know.
It's Art Pepper. My guest is Lori Pepper. Art Pepper's health was not good in the last years of his life.
No, it wasn't.
Was there a point where he assumed that he wouldn't live much longer?
I think he assumed he wouldn't live much longer when he was 10 years old, to tell you the truth. When I met him, he told me he wasn't going to live much longer. When I met him in Synanon, I mean, I think that was a refrain. I think he thought he had a limited time. And when he turned 50, I think he was utterly amazed. He was dumbfounded that he was still alive. He just could not believe it. So he thought that death was imminent. And when we began working on Straight Life, one of the first things he said is, I want to get this done because I know I'm dying. And yet he had 10 more years at that time.
Do you think that sense that, hey, I'm gonna die real soon, is mm-hmm. one of the reasons why he kept going back to drugs? Because he just didn't think it would matter in the long run, because he didn't think there'd be an in the long run?
Yeah, I think that that was, at least it was a good rationalization for him, that mm-hmm. why shouldn't he get high? He didn't have that much longer. He should live the way he wanted to. And he had a lot of rationalizations for using drugs. But I think, you know, and the more I think about it, the more it seems to me to be the truth that Art was so profoundly troubled emotionally, and whatever they're learning these days about brain chemistry or whatever, he was such a troubled soul, and he suffered so. He was so unbelievably sensitive to the stuff that most of us can deal with, that I think he was self-medicating all his life. I think he was just trying to ease the pain, and because things were more real to him than they are to the rest of us. Things were so intense to him. And so he had a lot of rationalizations, but I think in the long run, it was the only way he could live.
Did he die in a lot of pain?
No. No, he didn't. He died insofar as it's possible to know you're dying and have it be an easy death. He died with very little pain. He had a cerebral hemorrhage. We didn't know it. He had a headache, and he never, never had headaches. I get migraines, but he never had headaches. And so I took him to the doctor, and it happened very quickly after that. But he knew he was dying. He told me in the car as I was driving him to the hospital, and he said he wanted me to know that he'd had a good life, and he wanted to thank me for what I had done. He felt that he'd done everything that he had to do. I told you that when the odds were against him, he rose to the occasion. And I can't think of any more difficult occasion than your own death. He was beautiful. You know, he was amazing, amazingly courageous. And he said all these things. And then we were in the hospital, and he was lying there on the table, and his entire left side became paralyzed. And he told me, "You don't know how scared I am." And I just started hugging him and kissing him. And he said, "That's what I need. I need love." And he was, you know, he did the hardest things so well. And he died well. And but he knew he was dying for so long. It was not a surprise. It was what he'd been waiting for.
Did you have a sense that he really wanted his music to live on after his death? That what happened to his music after his death was very important?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's this great... I was listening to some tape, live performance of his at some nightclub, and he gave this fantastic performance of something, and the audience was just screaming and yelling. And Art said into the microphone, he said, "That just goes to show, you know." He said, "That goes to show that you can cheat death. You can cheat death." And I just shivered when I heard that, because that's what he was up to.
Lori Pepper. She's helping to reissue the recordings of her late husband, saxophonist Art Pepper. She also co-wrote his autobiography, Straight Life, which was recently brought out in a new edition featuring an afterword by Lori Pepper. We're listening to Art Pepper's 1952 recording of his composition, Straight Life. Coming up, a review of the film The Juror. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Ted Talley was a prize-winning playwright before he broke into screenwriting with White Palace in 1990. That movie took no one by storm, but his next movie, released the following year, did. It was called Silence of the Lambs. Now Talley has combined forces with the British-born director Brian Gibson, whose last movie was What's Love Got to Do with It? Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of The Juror.
It would have been hard to live in America during the last few weeks without seeing ads for The Juror. And if you saw those ads, it would have been hard not to come away feeling you'd already seen the movie. The commercials make the premise all too obvious. Demi Moore plays the single mom who's serving on a jury in a mob trial. Alec Baldwin plays the thug who's trying to terrorize her into voting the local godfather not guilty. What makes The Juror intriguing is not what's going on in the story, but how that story's told, how the usual cliched speeches have been written to sound new again, and how they're played by the actors, especially by Alec Baldwin. His character, known only as the teacher, is in the mold of a lot of suave, hyper-educated psychopaths. He's conversant with modern art, spouts Taoist wisdom at the drop of a hat, and knows he's a whole lot smarter than the goons he works for. Cast Dennis Hopper in the part, and you've got a movie you've seen a million times. But Baldwin doesn't play the role, he croons it. He brings a real erotic sizzle to the proceedings, purring his lines and sneaking through the darkness on little cat feet. And when his character starts falling in love with his prey, Baldwin makes you believe he has the passion to break all the rules. He and screenwriter Ted Talley know we've seen movies like this one before, so they can afford to be winking and elusive in the storytelling. And the results are scenes like this one, in which Baldwin toys with Demi Moore so insidiously that the threat itself never has to be enunciated.
Annie, listen to me now. You're in danger, and your son is in danger.
Oliver, what do you mean? Where's my son?
He went with Jesse and Julia to the movies, didn't he? He's gonna be all right. Such an extraordinary child. Remember last night when the two of you were playing that video game upstairs and you started to panic and he said, chill out, Mamba. You remember that?
How do you know that?
Annie. When I heard the two of you together laughing, I swore to myself that I would do everything to make sure that he gets through this. Do you understand me, Annie? This is a very dangerous time for him. He could stray. He could commit some childish error, and we could lose him. That quick.
Even Demi Moore is better than usual in this movie. She's quieter and less showy, and she doesn't shove her emotions at us. Instead, she lets us see those emotions bubble up in her and finally break through the surface. For the first time, she's really touching on screen. The movie is a pretty sleek product, although shards of something much rougher and clumsier still poke through. Like, for instance, the way The Godfather, who's on trial, seems like a throwback to mob movies of the 70s. And then there's the dopey ending in a small town in Guatemala, where there's that perpetual fiesta that's always going on when movies travel to small towns in Guatemala. Still, for every cliché that the picture trots out, there's another one that it turns upside down. I've never seen a crime film in which the witness storms into the DA's office and actually demands to wear a wire. And I've never seen a character quite like the one played by the fascinating newcomer Anne Heche as Demi Moore's best friend. She's a doctor, but her main interest is sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and Heche makes her distinctively avid and sensual. The Juror isn't Sense and Sensibility. But for those of us who enjoy a sludgy crime thriller from time to time, well, let's just say The Juror's thrills-to-sludge ratio is unusually favorable.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Jerry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Guilty, The Collapse of Criminal Justice by Harold J. Rothwax. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.